Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dell, NAB Trade's Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. We've spoken regularly on the podcast about exchange-traded funds and about indices, the benchmarks that tell us what a market as a whole has delivered. These concepts and products have become so widely used, it's easy to forget that they're based on a set of market theories, and they were created in response to a great wealth of research showing that it's actually really, really difficult to consistently outperform the market or the average of what everyone else is doing. Today I have Craig Lazara, Managing Director and Global Head of Index Investment Strategy for S&P Dow Jones Indices, to talk through some of the research and what it means in practice. Craig, thanks so much for joining me.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
So Craig, can you tell us a little bit about the research that S&P undertakes for a start?
Okay. Well, S&P Dow Jones Indices is one of, if not the largest index provider in the world. And our research kind of falls into two categories, one of which I'll mention and then move on. The one that I'll mention is a great deal of our work goes to the point of developing new index concepts. So someone will come to us, a client will say, I would love to have a portfolio or an index that could perform in the following way, and if we can figure out a way to make that happen that's repeatable and can be implemented cheaply, that's a big part of our work. The other part of our work is to be, as you said in the introduction, to be an advocate for, and I should say an informed advocate for, the notion of passive investing generally. Because there is a long history of research that demonstrates why passive investing is effective, why indices are the way they are, and why investors have found them useful. Let me give you, if I can, a little bit of history on that. The notion of a stock market index, say the S&P 500 or the S&P ASX 200 in Australia, comes about because years ago, before there was any thought of actually investing in an index fund, economists and other observers wanted to have an answer to the question, what is the stock market worth? Mm-hmm. Well, the way to find out what the stock market is worth is to take a representative set of stocks, say the 200 in the ASX 200, every day, or every 2 seconds, if you wish, every day, find the closing price of each stock, times the number of shares outstanding, add all that up, that's the value of the stock market. Do the same thing tomorrow, it's the value of the stock market tomorrow. The change in value from day one to day two is obviously the return of the stock market. Now that is, we call that capitalization weighted because the importance of each stock in that computation is proportionate to how big it is. Now, there's a stock with a $100 billion capitalization is twice as important as a stock with a $50 billion capitalization, naturally enough. And that's what capitalization stock market indices are. And almost all of the indices, the broad indices that your listeners will be familiar with, so ASX 200, S&P 500, those indices of that ilk are all capitalization weighted. Now, serendipitously, capitalization weighting has a very useful property. And that is, if I, instead of simply using an index as an indicator, if I decide to invest in an index as a portfolio, and I invest in a capitalization-weighted index, let's say Apple Computer is 4% of the S&P 500, let's say it does very well for the next month, it's going to be more than 4% of the S&P 500 next month, and if I simply buy the entire capitalization-weighted index, it's going to be more than 4% of my portfolio. I don't have to transact except when the index changes, if I hold a capitalization-weighted portfolio, which means that holding a cap-weighted index fund is a low-cost way to be invested in the stock market. Now, as I mentioned, that's completely serendipitous. When the S&P 500 goes back in its current form to 1957, and I can assure you that in 1957, no one had any idea that you could build portfolios based on this and have index funds and derivatives and ETFs and the like. No one knew that. So it's completely serendipitous. But what happened was, increasingly, and this really took place in the US beginning in the decade of the 70s, it became apparent that the average investment manager, the professional investment manager, underperformed the stock market as a whole, particularly underperformed the S&P 500. And you kind of ask the question, why is that, and what led to it, and why did it happen then, interestingly enough? And the answer is, it has to do with what some professors call the arithmetic of active management. And what that means is that if all of us in this room are the investors in a particular market, if I'm going to be above average, one of you has to be below average.
Mm-hmm.
There's no, the sum of what all the investors own adds up to everything that the market is.
Yeah.
And so for someone to be above average, someone else has to be below average. And in fact, the weighted average sum of the outperformance of the winners is exactly equal to the weighted average sum of the underperformance of the losers before costs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what that means is that if you're in an environment where, let's say, 20% of the total assets of a market are managed by professional investment managers, and the other 80% are in the hands of what I will call undiversified amateurs.
Mm.
All 20% of the professionals can be above average in that, because the source of their outperformance is the 80% undiversified amateurs. But what happens when the professionals grow to the point where they are the dominant force in the market? Well, then they're competing against each other. And it's increasingly difficult for any of them to have a sustainable long-run advantage over the others. And as I mentioned, that began to be noticed. The earliest studies that I'm aware of go to 1932.
Wow.
And it was not done as elegantly as it would be today, but surprisingly elegantly. And it came up with the same answer that professors came up with and analysts came up with in the 70s, and the same answer we come up with today, and that is that the majority of active managers underperformed an unmanaged index in the U.S., the S&P 500. As I mentioned, that became an obvious observation in the 1970s, because by the 70s, the importance of the undiversified amateurs had diminished to the point where the market was entirely professionalized. And so as you see that repeating in Australia and Europe, elsewhere, where you see the growth of professional investment management and the relative shrinkage of, when I say undiversified amateur, it's not a pejorative term. My grandmother was an undiversified amateur.
You know,
she was a fine person. But someone who isn't in the investment management business, who owns stocks nonetheless, that's what I mean. And as professionals became more and more important, this arithmetic of active management clicked in. It became increasingly difficult to outperform. Now we at S&P Dow Jones have contributed to that research, not back in the 70s, but starting in 2001 in the U.S. and then in rolling it out globally since then, with a report called, we call SPIVA, S-P-I-V-A, which stands for S&P Index versus Active. And what we do in the SPIVA database is to look at, access a database of actively managed funds, and then compare the performance of those managers to an index fund that is indicative of their style of management. So in Australia, you compare them to the ASX 200, in the US to the S&P 500, if it's a mid-cap manager, S&P mid-cap 400, or S&P mid-cap, small-cap 600. So it's apples to apples as nearly as we can make it. And the verdict of SPIVA consistently is that the average active manager underperforms a benchmark that's appropriate to his investment style. It's true in the US, it's true in Australia, it's true in Europe, it's true in South America, it's true everywhere we've looked, which is basically everywhere we can find a set of data, a database of fund returns, active fund returns, that is accurate. So that observation that first came up in the 70s is still alive and well, and if anything is becoming, I think, more and more challenging for active managers.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to note you talk about the undiversified amateurs. In Australia, yes, we have the fourth largest funds management industry in the world, which is extraordinary for such a tiny population, but it's underpinned by our superannuation market, which is very mature relative to other countries. I'm privileged to have it, even though it has some holes in it. So this is really relevant for Australians.
Yeah.
Most Australians will have... we also have a very high proportion of direct share ownership in Australia also, relative to other sort of developed countries and developed markets. The Australian investors almost definitely will have some money in the market with a professional fund manager through their superannuation. So it's very relevant for Australian investors, even if they manage their own personal funds directly. One of the findings that you talk to in your research is persistence. Can you talk about that for me?
Yes, persistence is a companion to SPIVA, comes from the same database. And the notion of persistence really arose from client, or I should say active manager objections to SPIVA, because SPIVA has very consistently said what I mentioned earlier, the average active manager has underperformed. I think in the U.S. we have 17 years of data, and only three as the average active manager outperformed the S&P 500. So very consistent results. And the objection that, or the question that got raised was, well, that's fine, the average may underperform, but might it not be the case that there are some managers who are consistently above average, if you can identify them? Or is there another way to say that? Is there persistence in skill among the most skillful managers? And there's no theoretical reason that can't be the case. So what we did in the SPIVA database, there are a number of ways to slice it, but here I'll give you one example, is to go back 5 years, say, find all the managers who were in the above average 5 years ago, whether they beat the market or not, just they were above average. And then ask if they were above average 5 years ago, were they also above average 4 years ago, 3 years, 2 years, 1 year? So you could look at the subsequent 4 years. And generally when we do that, the results vary from year to year, but generally you'll see that between 5 and 10%, typically at the low end of that range, but 5 to 10% of top quartile managers 5 years ago were in the top quartile in each of the subsequent 4 years. Now the top half, I should say, in the subsequent 5 years. Now the chance of flipping a coin and getting four heads in a row is 6.25%. And what I always say when I summarize persistence data is that your chance of picking a manager who will be above average 4 years in a row is about the same as your chance of flipping a coin and getting four heads in a row. It certainly can happen, but it's a random event. Another exercise we do with SPIVA and this with persistence, and this we do both in the U.S. and Australia, we have data enough to do it, is to go back, let's say 10 years of data, take the first 5 years, identify all the managers who were in the top quartile in the first 5 years, and say, well, how do they do in the second 5 years? And you'd expect some, if there is in fact persistence, you'd expect most of them still to be in the top quartile. If skill is more or less randomly distributed, you'd expect about 25% of them to still be in the top quartile, and that's what you find. Typically, roughly 25%, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less, are still in the top quartile in the second 5 years if they started out that way. In Australia, certainly, and quite often in the U.S., there's a slightly greater likelihood, statistically, that a manager will go from the top quartile to the bottom and that he will remain in the top. So all that data, it kind of coupled with SPIVA, basically says that the average active manager underperforms most of the time, and that excellent performance when you find it tends not to persist. And both those things obviously push investors and observers in the direction of saying it would be to my advantage simply to invest in an unmanaged index fund, because that will, over time, would have assured me, and there are good reasons to believe that will continue, would have assured me of being an above average performer.
So I find this really interesting. I did my honors thesis on exactly this topic quite some time ago. And my favorite thing about it was that over the 12-year period that we chose, simply because that was the data set that was available at the time. Mm-hmm. You learn a lot about data sets when you're doing
this kind
of work.
Yes,
so mine was from 1991 to 2003, the data set in question. And we looked at superannuation fund managers. That was only interesting to the extent that superannuation is somewhat more expensive to manage. So the management fees were higher, and part of that was the administration cost of managing the trustee relationship and all that stuff. One out of the there were several hundred in there over that time period, just because of the way the industry was structured at the time. There was one fund manager who outperformed consistently through that period, and it was statistically valid and all of those things. And most Australians at that point in time would have known the name of that fund manager and been very happy to have their money with them. What was not part of the published results was, had we moved the time frame by 2 years either way, so from 89 or to 2005, that fund manager would have dropped out. Yes. So had you chosen that fund manager for 12 years, you'd had a great 12 years, it was fantastic, but had you chosen them in 89?
But the 13th year was not his day.
Yeah, it was no longer true.
Day,
yeah. So it was a very educational process. I'm glad I did it.
Yeah, well, one of the things that it's related to, Gemma, to that is the notion, and this is one of the things we're very careful about with the SPIVA database, is that you want when you look at data of that sort, you want to look at a database that is, in the jargon, survivorship free, adjusted for survivorship bias. Because if you're not careful, let's say you look today and I look at the last 20 years of numbers, I'm not getting 20 years of numbers of all managers. I'm getting 20 years of numbers from the managers who survived 20 years.
Yes.
Which means they were good enough to survive 20 years. That's not the same database as all the managers who existed 20 years ago. And you need to be very careful about that in doing this kind of work.
Yeah, we did control for that. That was also a very early lesson.
Yes, exactly.
once you try to add those, but again, data is quite
it's
difficult. You've got to add
those
people
back in. Exactly.
Got to somehow, though, they slip through the cracks a little bit. So one of the points that you have made in your research, and it is very valuable, is that not all managers underperform all the time. And so this point is, and it came through in my research, there was one for a 12-year period who consistently outperformed. Obviously, you had to pick exactly the right time frame and exactly the right manager, which is extraordinarily difficult to do. But most Australians, as I said, would have known the name of that fund manager at that particular point in time. So they were very popular and had been consistently very successful, both at attracting funds and performing. So are there characteristics that come through strongly in your research which are more likely to put a manager in the top quartile, even for a shorter period of time? Is there anything that stands out to you as being indicative of a manager less likely to underperform? Should I put it that way?
Well, let me answer the question this way. There are really two strands to the answer, I think. One is, if you look at the history of the SPIVA database, there are some environments which are more challenging than others, and that's a fair way to say it. All environments are challenging. I mean, you're looking at a history where most active managers failed, so it's a challenging environment. That's the baseline. There are some environments which are somewhat easier for active managers. So, for example, we often do a lot of work around a concept that we call dispersion. Think of dispersion as, well, technically it's a standard deviation kind of measure for listeners who are statistically minded, but it's just a measure of the breadth of outcomes in a given market at a given point in time. So if dispersion is very narrow at a particular point in time or in a particular market, that's a more difficult environment for active managers than if dispersion is very wide. Because even if I'm a good stock picker, even if I'm a great stock picker, if dispersion is small, my ability to add value is diminished because there just isn't the gap between the average and the best performing stocks. Well, that's one environment that seems to be more challenging. Low dispersion is more challenging. Another environment that's more challenging is if the very largest stocks in the market are the market leaders. And this particularly, say in the US, we did a formal study of this and defined what we call mega caps, as anything that was 1% of the S&P 500 or more. There are usually about 15 to 20 of them at any point in time. And we know that Apple, Amazon, we know all the names. The reason that makes for difficulties is that if a manager is invested in a non-mega cap, he is almost certainly overweighted.
Yeah.
If he's invested in a mega cap, he may not be overweighted. You know, Apple's 4% of the S&P 500. You might have a 3% position. You're actually underweighted in Apple. Mm. And if you aren't, either event, your ability to be overweighted is diminished because the stock itself is so big in the benchmark. Well, if the mega caps do really well, as they did in the U.S., in 2017, for example, that is a challenging environment for active managers because most of them are underweighted net in the mega caps. It's harder to be overweight. That's a second thing. The third thing that I'd identify from our work has to do with what's sometimes called the low volatility effect or the low beta effect in markets. And without belaboring the point, I'll tell you how we did the study. We have an index called the S&P 500 Low Volatility Index. It's the 100 least volatile stocks in the S&P 500 rebalanced quarterly. When that index does really well relative to the S&P 500, it's a particularly challenging time for active managers. If that index does badly, in other words, if more volatile stocks do better than less volatile stocks, which is a minority circumstance, but if that happens, that's typically better for active managers. In other words, another way to say that or to summarize what that implies is that the average active manager in the U.S. is tilted toward higher volatility stocks. So all of those things will tell you something about the nature of the environment. So if you tell me that a particular year is a year when dispersion is very wide and large cap stocks don't dominate performance and more volatile stocks do, my reaction would be that might be a year when the number of managers who underperform goes down.
Yeah.
Whereas if the opposite is true, I'd say that the number goes up. All that said, that's all qualification and one answer to your question. The other answer to your question is that any investor who thinks he can choose a manager who will be consistently above average should realize that the odds are against him. There's nothing wrong with doing it.
Yeah.
You can try. Sometimes, as you alluded, you'll succeed. But realize the odds are against you. I mean, in the U.S., there's a quite famous manager. I don't know if he's known well here. Peter Lynch, who ran the Fidelity
yes,
Magellan
very well
Fund
known here. Yeah.
In the decade of the 80s. I was, among many things that make me feel old now, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal several years ago noting the 25th anniversary of his retirement. I said, how could it be 25 years? He retired? I can't believe that. It's been 25 years. But it was. And not surprisingly, Peter Lynch believes in active management. And Peter Lynch knows about it, but was good at active management. There's no question of those things. So he's one of those characters. Warren Buffett, obviously,
Warren
is another
Buffett's
very well-known.
But I
remember writing about the Wall Street Journal's retrospective of Peter Lynch at the time, and I said, look, the data are very clear. The data say that the majority of active managers underperform most of the time and that when success occurs, it tends not to persist. Mm. Very clear in the data. Those are the rules. Are there exceptions to the rules? Could there be exceptions? Yes, there could be exceptions to the rules. The reason you know Peter Lynch's name is because he was exceptional. If it were easy to do, we could all do it. but as I say, the ones who are famous because they're rare. Mm. And that's the point. It's hard to find them in advance.
Mm. So there is one other factor that does come through quite strongly in your research, and that's cost. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Cost is if I make a list of the things that explain why SPIVA results are the way they are, cost is always first on the list,
right?
Because it's easy to explain. And I alluded earlier to what Professor William Sharpe called the arithmetic of active management. Mm-hmm. And the arithmetic of active management works like this. Imagine a market where there's active investors and passive investors, and whatever the market is, it is what it is. The passive investors say, I want to own a pro rata slice of every stock in the market. I'm not going to try to pick who's going to do well or badly. I buy a pro rata chunk of everything. So let's say the passive investors are 20% of the market. They buy 20% of every stock. Mm. That means the active investors own 80% of every stock. The aggregate portfolio of the active managers is identical to the aggregate portfolio of the passive managers. It's four times larger in that example, but they own the same portfolio. Not every active manager, but the aggregate of all of them. Now, given that active managers have to charge higher fees, they have to pay for research, they have to pay for trading.
There's work involved,
obviously,
yeah.
Higher fees associated with active managers than passive. Given that, then what Sharpe said in the arithmetic of active manager was, it is mathematically certain that the average active manager must underperform the average passive manager, without any doubt. Now, to put some numbers on it, it varies from place to place, obviously. We did some research about a year ago looking at mutual fund data in the U.S., and that research said that the average actively managed equity fund, I think, charges a fee of about 80 basis points. The average passively managed fund charged a fee of, and this research had 10 basis points, although it can be much less, I can tell you from experience. So there's a gap of, say, 70 basis points. every year, which even if the active manager in question, or the average active manager, were able to pick stocks that did as well as the S&P 500 before costs, they have to do at least 70 basis points better to justify the incremental costs. And that's something that's quite difficult to do. Now, my understanding, obviously much less developed in Australia than in the US, is that fees here are at that level or even higher. And so the burden for active managers to overcome is greater yet and likely to continue.
You're absolutely correct. So Australian managers tend to charge higher fees than US-based managers just because there's less competition.
Yeah.
Smaller market, less competition, and fees have not dropped as dramatically. But that is also true for passive funds. So passive funds are more expensive here than in the US. Not quite as much competition for that either.
Well, and passive investing, much more than active, is a business of scale. Mm. I mean, it doesn't cost much more to run $10 billion than it does to run $1 billion. Now, active, that may not be the case, but in passive, it is very often true. So I would expect, and we've seen this in the U.S., as the percentage of assets that are invested passively has grown, costs have gone down.
Yeah, I think many investors will hope to see that also.
Yeah, I would.
Yeah. So one interesting question for you. So markets are very different around the world, and you've alluded to Australia. Australia has a very well-developed, well-regulated liquid market. As I said, a huge funds management market relative to the size of population. Europe and the US. We talked about South America as well. Are there, do you find emerging markets or any asset classes in particular where this research doesn't hold, or the findings of the research don't hold up so well?
Actually not, which is kind of surprising. Mm-hmm. For two, well, there's one reason that's surprising and there's one reason for the virtual explanation. But the surprising part goes back to what I said earlier about the importance of professional versus amateur investors. Mm. So if you can identify a market where, it's a US or Australia, a good example, where the market is dominated by professionals, that's a place where it would be highly unlikely for the average professional to outperform. If you can find a market where the market is not dominated by professionals. And there are many, you know, South American markets are like that, India is like that, China is like that. I mean, the emerging markets generally, they don't have as well-developed a fund management industry. In that environment, theoretically, it should be possible for the average active manager to outperform the market index. Now, where we have SPIVA data for India or Brazil or Chile and so forth, it's not true. But theoretically, it's possible. We don't see it. The other part of the answer to your question relates to something that we hear even in the U.S. very often, and the argument goes along the lines of that you should index large capitalization funds because they're very well researched and efficiently priced, whereas if you get to small mid caps or especially small caps, that's where you should use an active manager because they're less well researched. And that is that's a plausible. It's not true, but it's a plausible argument. It's not correct. I think that true makes it sound like there's some moral issue involved. It's not a correct argument.
There are two
things about it. One is that the data absolutely do not support that argument. If you look at small cap managers in the SPIVA database, they have just as hard a time as large cap managers, and just as hard a time mid cap as well. So that is part of the answer, or part of the rebuttal, or the answer to that argument, is that you look at the data and you find what you find. So that calls for an explanation, I think. And the explanation, I think, goes this way. It is true that smaller cap stocks are less well researched than large. That clearly is true.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly in the U.S., I suspect everywhere as well. That is true. It follows from that the possibility of misvaluation is higher for small cap stocks than it is for large cap stocks. It does not follow that the possibility or the probability of undervaluation is higher for large cap than small cap. And in fact, that the argument that the active managers make when they say you should index large cap and be active in small cap assumes that undervaluation is more prevalent in the small cap world because there's less coverage. In fact, I would argue that as between under and overvaluation, if anything, smaller cap issues are more likely to be overvalued. The reason for that is that if you want to, if you as an active manager see what you perceive as undervaluation, you want to take advantage of it. You go out and buy the stock. It's easy to get rid of, or it's easy to explain what you would do in reaction. If you see a stock that's overvalued, there's not much you can. If you're a long-only manager, there's nothing you can do about it, more or less. If you're an active hedge fund or a trading desk, maybe you can short the stock. In order to short the stock, you have to borrow the stock. Yeah. In order to borrow the stock, you have to pay to borrow. There's some institutions that can't do that legally, and even if you can, it's a gigantic pain. And so the likelihood is that overvaluation can persist much more so than undervaluation, and that would suggest then that the argument that, or explain why, the data on small cap managers are just as challenging as they are for large cap.
I think also the point that you're making is that just because something's undervalued as a small cap doesn't mean it's going to converge on its true valuation at any point.
Well, that's true generally. I mean, you always have to be aware of that. If you're buying stocks as an active manager because you think they're undervalued, nobody is more articulate about this than the really good value managers like Warren Buffett, right?
You
must be prepared to be patient, and if you're not prepared to be patient, do not try to be a value manager, because it may take longer than you think. Even if you're right, the length of time it takes the market to appreciate that you're correct. Maybe longer than you can stand to be there.
Yes, the market can stay irrational a lot longer than you can stay solvent.
Precisely.
Pretty sure Warren Buffett can stay solvent than most of us.
He's
in his 90s, so he's managed to. There's a lot of survivorship bias there in literal terms.
But Buffett is an interesting case, and I mean, obviously, with anyone who is in this business should have enormous respect for what he's accomplished. But one of the things that Warren Buffett has going for him is that he's Warren Buffett, and people know. Based on a very long and successful career. I mean, if you and I started an investment company tomorrow and bought the exact same portfolio that Warren Buffett bought, and we had a bad first year, we'd lose all our assets. And all of his clients would say, well, it's Warren Buffett. You know, we know he's going to do well in the long run. And that's a very valuable resource. And he's earned it. But it's important to him.
There is in Australian folklore a businessman more than an investor who took a very similar approach, where frankly he traded his name more than the companies. There's certain legal and ethical implications with doing that, which you'd never suggest Buffett is doing.
No, absolutely not. It's the having the reputation of being a skillful active manager is worth a tremendous amount, because it will keep clients from abandoning you at exactly the wrong time. Now, in order to have the reputation of being a really skilled active manager, it helps a great deal actually to be a really skilled active manager. Actually, to have it be true. And in his case, okay, I can see it's probably true.
He's certainly got the data behind him for many decades. It's nice to have many decades to support you. Craig, you and your team produce some fantastic content that investors can access directly, which is really valuable. Where would people go to keep up to date with all these insights?
Well, I appreciate your saying that. The easiest way for investors to keep up is to go to our webpage, which is www.spdji, S&P Dow Jones Indices, but spdji.com. That's where all of our research will be, and all of our work on new index development will be. There's also a site that we have an active blog, which includes our work as well as others, and that's called indexologyblog.com. But either of those will get investors into the treasure house of S&P Dow Jones data.
It's for people who are interested in this topic and to understand it more deeply, it's incredibly valuable, and you put some really cool stuff up there. So thank you so much for your time today. As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. We hope it has been helpful to you in your journey to creating wealth. We always love to hear from you, so if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.